Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Fake the Nation, episode 375.
Hello, hello. This is Fake the Nation, where we talk about news. We talk about culture and where we wonder if that random ad that Nicole Kidman, where she keeps promoting some sort of vitamin to make her look gorgeous, if that is true, because I'm your host, Nagin Farsad, and I, as cautious as I am a total sucker for a celebrity vitamin scheme. You know what I mean? I'll buy it. I'll try it. I'll look at my collagen in my skin and see if it's working. Today, we're going to talk about the popularity of the Roman Empire, about shrinkflation in France. We're going to talk about the ongoing writer and actor strike. And finally, Mitt Romney. What is his deal? Today, I'm so excited by today's panel, folks. Today's panel is incredible. We are joined with this. You've heard this gentleman on the show before. I think of his podcast as a sister podcast for some reason. They've been so kind to me over the years. He's host of the podcast Yo, Is This Racist? He's also a WGA writer on strike, and we're going to be talking about that, so he's incredibly useful for that discussion. And he's just wonderful and fabulous. He is the wonderful Andrew T. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, what's up?
Oh my gosh, it's so good to have you on.
Great to be here.
Rejoining our podcast forces as we have done in the past.
Yes.
And also on the panel today, for the very first time, now, I mean, it feels ridiculous that we haven't met before, and yet we haven't. He's a stand-up comedian. He was the former head writer for The Late Late Show with James Corden, because he's just such a talented motherfucker. And he's also the author of a book that's coming out toot sweet, you guys. It's called The T-Shirt Swim Club. It is now available for pre-order, and you must pre-order it. What are you doing? It's a book. It's fun. It's fun. I mean, I can tell from the title, T-Shirt Swim Club, though I have not read it. I know for a fact that it's funny. It is the one and only Ian Carmel. Unless this is your ode to, like, euthanasia or something. I'm not sure what this book is exactly about, but I imagine...
It is a 60,000-word epic poem about euthanasia. written in Greek in the original style of Homer.
Again? Yeah. You just can't stop with that shit.
If I'm anything, I'm cliche. It's a part memoir, part book of essays about growing up fat and being fat. I used to be much fatter than I am now. I'm still fat, but about growing up fat as a kid and as a fat man and everything. And then my sister, who is a clinical psychologist, comes in after every chapter and kind of talks about what I was going through. So it was a lot of fun to write. It's out in June, but you can pre-order it now. And I'm supposed to push
it. Wow, like a brother-sister collab.
Yeah, that's wild.
Very interesting. Sorry, are you guys hearing that?
No.
Oh, you're not hearing that. Okay, it's my phone. I need to put it on airplane mode. Here we go. Sorry, it was ringing onto my computer, and I don't know. Oh. I can't disconnect that. Here we go. This is when you learn that you're podcasting with your grandmother. That's what just happened there. Folks, before we get into the show, I just want to remind listeners they can go to patreon.com/Nagin Farsad, everyone's grandmother, and get bonus episodes of the show by supporting the show, subscribing at patreon.com/Nagin Farsad. We do fun and ridiculous bonus episodes. We also have fun and ridiculous essays and videos and mugs and t-shirts. And oh my God, there's so many tiers. So don't forget to go to patreon.com/Nagin Farsad. And by the way, if you are in Boston or in Cambridge or anywhere nearby, I'm going to be at MIT on Friday, September 22nd. So come out and see me. It'll be so much fun. I'm going to be doing my whole hour.
You're performing at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology?
where all comedians just, I mean, the hotbed of comedy, MIT, that is where I'm performing,
when,
in fact.
When I have a college gig, it's like the Little Rock Community College of School in like geology and architecture, and you're performing at MIT. That's amazing.
Oh my, like, and also I'm doing like a mini tour of the top tier, because I did Columbia like a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, yeah. Just yes to brag.
Michigan sent you an offer and you were like, please,
have a little dignity.
No, I know you're hard to get into, but come on, we don't consider you Ivy.
folks, now I feel gross. Okay, now let us move on to topic number one, the amuse-bouche. We're going to amuse your bouche by addressing a question that's on all of our mind, which is, how often do men think of the Roman Empire? And this isn't just like a random thing that popped into my head. No. This has been trending on TikTok. Basically, TikTokers have been asking the men in their lives, brothers, husbands, fathers, what have you, how often they think about the Roman Empire. And the highly non-scientific findings are that dudes think about the Roman Empire like every day. Oh, like a surprising and alarming number of them think about the Roman Empire every day. So my first question to the two of you, since I have two gentlemen on the panel today, my first question is, obviously, how often do you think of the Roman Empire?
Ian, I feel like you have more think of Roman Empire vibes than me at least.
Thank you very much.
I'm not saying you're like a big Roman boy.
I'm constantly conquering the Gauls, so it makes sense that I think about it a lot. I can't stop every weekend. I'm out there conquering the Gauls. To be honest, I almost never think about anything. This was my initial reaction. My wife walked in and it was like, how often do you think about the Roman Empire? And like, my honest answer is like, my brain is usually, it just looks like Wyoming. It's just dusty. Yeah. There's nothing there. It's a windswept plain. Unless someone brings up the Roman Empire. And then
it's just gladiators nonstop. Andrew, where are you at?
I think this creates its own thing. Yeah, I think like, got to the nature of what is thinking about something mean? Because the answer is like, yeah, like never. I think I mostly think of the Roman Empire because I took Latin in high school like a big old nerd. And my favorite word that still comes up in my adulthood is arbiter bibendi, which is the guy who determines how much everyone's going to drink. And that's my only Latin.
So how often do you think of arbiter bibendi?
That comes up, you know, more than you think at a bar or such. But I don't know if I consider that the Roman Empire, because I feel like that was just a dude who happened to be Roman. But is he part of the empire? I don't know. I guess he's usually a citizen, so that's the one and only. But yeah, other than that, never.
A lot of these dudes were sort of praising just the primacy of the empire. But I think a lot of them are thinking about gladiators.
Yes. The movie Gladiator. The movie Gladiator, I think, like, I have also, this is my admission. I've never seen Gladiator.
Oh,
like, I've seen enough clips that I get it. But yeah, and it's just, I don't know. I missed it and I know I'll see it someday.
Okay,
but
if we're doing admissions right now, my admission is I'm not sure if I've ever seen Gladiator.
You both need to.
There's a chance that I've seen it and it meant so little to me that I don't remember if I've seen it.
If you ever run into Hans Zimmer and he finds out that you haven't seen Gladiator, his finest work, in my opinion, it's going to break his tiny little German
heart. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
By
contrast, I think of Hans Zimmer. I think of Hans Zimmer almost daily. So yeah.
Okay, perfect, perfect.
So I sort of make up for it, as an individual.
That's your Roman Empire. It's like
my Roman Empire.
You're on a subway, you're thinking about Hans Zimmer. I think a big part of this like Roman Empire thing like this, you ever run into all those people on Twitter who it's usually an unpleasant interaction, like their picture is like a is like a marble statue and their name is like Western Culture Defender or something like that.
You're right.
And they have like a Marcus Aurelius quote like in their bio. I think there's some part of thinking about the Roman Empire that harkens back, I don't know, something kind of uncomortable, something like very, very white and powerful. about it now.
I will just say, I mean, you know, half of the people who are loving the Roman Empire are loving them because of this is the non-modern pejorative version. They were the original fascists.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think some of the current, yes, pejorative fascists love the old school. So,
but I also want to point out that some historians have jumped into the fray to note that there were, quote, numerous forms of masculinity. Women could have agency and power, and there were multiple gender expressions and identities, as well as various sexualities. Yeah. So I think, unlike your sort of swashbuckling masculinity of later centuries, potentially thinking about the Roman Empire is a little less fraught.
They were also they would also take the way they conquered, they didn't overtake areas, cultures or religions. They would just incorporate other gods into their pantheon. So that's how
they just added.
They would just be and now that's one of the Roman gods. So everything's hunky dory.
right.
And that's why
right,
you would see these temples to like different gods in different places.
It
actually, I mean, I will say, having read about this trend, and now that I've read about this trend, the trend is probably totally dead. I feel like once a trend gets to my eyeballs, as we've established, I'm the grandmother of the podcast, it's over. But I think my initial reaction was a lot like yours, Ian, which is that I don't feel like I think about historical eras at all.
No.
I mean, just and then I'm just oh my God, am I just a fucking dum-dum? Is everyone sitting there being well, the Aztecs, is it 1 p.m.? I better think about the Ottoman Empire now. That's what I do daily. You know what I mean? I just don't think about history in that way, which made me feel just a little less than. So that's my honest truth. And that I don't remember if I've seen Gladiator.
I just want to know what's going when this person who thinks about it once a day is thinking about the Roman Empire. Are they just sitting there aqueducts? What is okay, the...
Yeah. Right. Lead poisoning.
I also want to say, as the mother of a four-year-old girl, I see a lot of four-year-old boys, and there's a lot of sword interest among young boys that I imagine sort of carries forward. So it could be a vague sword interest.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or just squabbling with fisticuffs, fighting. I think the Colosseum, the movie Gladiator, really, I've seen enough clips. I get the gist.
You gotta get in there, man.
Hans Zimmer broke his foot off in that thing. I'm telling you.
Okay, let's move on to more important matters. The French grocery chain Carrefour. As listeners know, I lived in France for a little bit, so it's not a big deal.
Well done.
Je parle français un peu, mais... So the French grocery chain Carrefour is adding labels to products that shrank in size but increased in price. I mean, obviously, j'adore la France, but also these shrinkflation labels are basically a corporation shaming other corporations, which is another cute thing. I don't know. What do you think, Ian? Can corporations even be shamed? What do you think is happening over there in France?
At least in the United States, the Supreme Court ruled that corporations can be shamed. So if they're people, they can feel
people.
Shame.
I think
feeling shame is one of the fundamental aspects of being human. And thus, the Supreme Court says that corporations can feel shame. My opinion is anything food directed in France, especially when it comes to legislating or any of that thing, whichever way France goes, I will follow, because just their quality of ingredients, the care they put into it, the level of control they have over what can be considered a certain thing, whether it's champagne or what a baguette has to have. I don't know if this is if this is just a placebo effect or whatever, but anytime I go to France and I eat
I feel better.
I'm being executed the next day. I barely gain weight and I feel better. Yeah. And everyone says it's because the ingredients are better. And I don't know if that's true or not, but I'm going to assume it is. I want it to be. I'll just follow anything France does when it comes to food, including shrinkflation shaming.
Andrew?
Not to get ahead of our topics, but I think this is awesome because it's the first, normally corporations have such solidarity with each other. And to just see corporations openly talking shit about each other is so amazing and heartwarming. Like, just if this is like the Ralphs going like, you know what PepsiCo did? Your shit got jacked up 18 cents a fluid ounce. Like, that's crazy.
It's awesome, right?
There's probably clerks at this grocery store who are getting like screamed at in French, who are some of the best screamers, you know what I mean? Like on the planet, about like how come this costs more than it used to, blah, blah, blah. And they just got to be like, yo, it's not us. All right.
Yeah.
So let's just be very clear about that.
And among the corporations that are being shamed are Lipton iced tea, Pepsi, boxes of Lindt chocolate, certain baby milk powders. All of these things are being labeled with a shrinkflation label. And if you were to see it, would you be like, fuck these guys, I'm going to buy the competitor? I mean, I think I probably would. If I saw that label, I'd be like, fuck these guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is such an interesting method. And I also want to say, Carrefour, for those of you who don't know, again, I lived in France, so it's not a big deal. I happen to know.
Oh, wow.
I happened to have done some grocery shopping while I was
interesting.
There. And it is like fucking Vons. Like, it's like it's everywhere. It's the main grocery store. It's not like, there's tons of shitty food there as well. I mean, you know, it's everything in France is like kind of superior, but still, it's still garbage.
Yeah.
And so when you think it's not, don't think of it as like your high end something. That's not what Carrefour. This is like your straight up all over the country grocery store chain. So that's, let that vision be in your head.
Superior garbage is a good description of France in general.
Yeah. But also, Vons, take the notes. Start snitching on the other corporations.
I think that'll create some brand loyalty.
Absolutely.
All right, folks, let me know what you think about the shrinkflation measure in the French grocery store chain. I obviously love it. Let us take a quick break to learn about our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll continue chatting. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until, that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a like a roundabout 8 exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Folks, before we get back into the show, I just want to let you know I'll actually be at the Green Space on October 3rd. Join me and Dr. Jeffrey Lewis, nuclear expert and host of The Reason We're All Still Here, as we examine nuclear weapons and non-proliferation policies in the context of Dr. Strangelove. Yes, that Stanley Kubrick classic. We're going to be talking about the uncomfortable similarities between that movie and literally real life. What has been happening geopolitically around the country, around the world, including like what happened with the Iran nuclear deal. This is going to be a really fun show. It's going to be really wild. We'll get into why it falls on individuals with an outsider perspective to change the course of history. I don't know, maybe it's you. So join me on October 3rd at the Green Space in New York City for a really fun live show. You can find details and free tickets at gilded.audio/live. That's gilded.audio/live. Gilded is gilded.audio/live. It's going to be fun. And we are back and we're ready for topic number two. So, folks, as you know, we're in the middle of a double strike, SAG and AFTRA. I'm sorry, SAG-AFTRA and the WGA.
Yep.
Writers and actors. But in last week, Bill Maher, Drew Barrymore, and The Talk had all announced that they were going to defy the strike and resume production on their shows. But then came the backlash, and then all three of them have since backpedaled. I guess, what did you both think of their initial decision to return, and what did you make of the backpedaling? Like, what brought them to that?
I mean, with talk shows, maybe this just is like my, because of like my exposure to the previous strike, when like these talk shows did come back, the networks made like Conan come back, and he, you know, spun his wedding ring on his desk, like famously, because he didn't have writers. I kind of always thought the talk shows were going to come back.
Do the same thing. Yeah.
Anyway, because they just took, like they said it was for solidarity, but they just took their summer breaks.
The summer, yeah. You know?
like Drew Barrymore initially was like, I can't do this. And then like, I'm going to go on my summer break that I probably would have taken anyway.
I can't do this and I wouldn't have been working anyway, but don't think about that.
Right. It's the way I'm on strike when the show I worked on like ended a couple days before the strike. Like technically I'm on strike. But so I was very I was not that surprised when they were going back on air. I had solidarity with the rest of the people in my union, but it wasn't one of those things that would like upset me as much as if like a scripted show went back. Maybe just because I anticipated it. So I was honestly, I was pretty pleasantly surprised when they said they weren't going to go back on the air. Part of that, I think, is because they couldn't find guests. But
yeah,
I was very pleasantly surprised.
Well, so in 2000, again, my memory of the 2007 situation is very blurry. But were there guests in 2007 or not? Really?
There must have been because SAG wasn't on strike. So yeah. I feel like there would have been no reason to not have guests.
Right. Different type of strike. Right.
Yeah.
And yeah, so this feels hard. Yeah, you can't even get them to come promote stuff, so it doesn't make sense.
And even like on Twitter, you know, I saw like people who were like just, you know, like the Drew Barrymore type of guest, which is like someone who went pleasantly viral but is not a public figure in any way. I saw those people who like, you know, aren't members of SAG typically and like don't really have a reason not to go on, just saying they wouldn't cross a picket line.
Yeah.
Which is incredible. Yeah.
Like authors are like not going to cross a picket line for the most part. You, like the kind of politicians you would probably want on those shows aren't going to cross a picket line. It was like,
right.
So I truly don't know who they would have interviewed and they couldn't have any writers to fill all that time. It's hard to fill, you know, 60 minutes of TV show.
It's very hard. Unless you're podcasting, in which case you fucking blather on.
It's a breeze.
That was sort of the like thing where it's like, oh, like we're just gonna let Drew Barrymore like talk loose. Like, all right, I kind of want to see what happens.
Right. Well, so here's what Bill Maher said, and I wonder. I thought, you know, Bill Maher is a little has an acid tongue. He said they're asking.
Let's say comfortably anti-labor in vibe, if not.
Yes,
who knows?
Yes.
Who knows what he really believes? But I would be comfortable saying his vibe is anti-labor.
Club Random is not a union club. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so this is what he said. He said they're asking for a lot of things that are like kooky. What I find objectionable about the philosophy of this strike is it seems to be it's one of those things where you read someone else's quote and it doesn't sound like they're speaking English. They have morphed a long way from the 2007 strike where they kind of believe you're owed a living as a writer and you're not. So I guess where are you on this idea that you're owed a living as a writer? And I think it's an interesting position, right? Because it is the kind of job writers and actors – it's a privileged job. If you can make a living at it, you're very, very lucky. But really, it's not a necessity for anyone's life, right? Like, you're not a plumber. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what do you think? What do you make of this characterization from Bill Maher?
I will say he's being intentionally or maybe like, you know, he's being obtuse, whether intentionally or accidentally. But the ask is not that you are owed, that any given writer is, quote, owed a living. It's just that for the work that we do, and in the streaming era, there's like sort of commensurate and obvious like analogs, we are owed a living. So, I mean, I'm happy to give my example, which is I wrote on That 90s Show, which is a reboot of That 70s Show. And the creative was essentially the same. Everything about writing That 90s Show was in every way more or less identical to writing on That 70s Show, except because it was on Netflix, we had we had half the episode order, we had approximately a third of the writing staff, and in terms of residuals, I have written on one network show that was sort of a moderate show. And then apparently, but we don't know, That 90s Show was a quote unquote huge hit. And I have received per episode about 1/100th of the residuals for identical work. And that's sort of the difference. It's like, I am working or was working and now I'm on strike, but like, the work that I did is being compensated at pennies to the dollar compared to identical work for, according to them, you know, acceptable numbers of viewers. And that's the thing that we are striking against. Yeah. It is that, like, the streamers have taken away so much money for us doing the same thing at the same level, at the same quality.
And they can, I mean, the companies can modulate the way in which they like seek out compensation with the way, with the pace that the world changes. And they do, these production companies, you know what I mean? Like the, like if, and they, but if they would have like included us in that from the get go, we never would have had to strike, but they're like, okay, we've got the writers tied to this like archaic compensation program. Meanwhile, we figured out other ways to make money. I mean, like, if late night, for example, and this isn't even a thing that's on the table in the strike, but like, we got paid fairly because we were on network television every single night. We, when we got sold overseas, we got residuals, blah, 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 blah. But also, you know, we would write carpool karaoke's or Crosswalk the Musicals or those kind of things that would get some of these carpool karaoke's 60 million hits on YouTube, more than that. Right. Like, the amount of compensation that would be given to, like a creator on YouTube.
There were ad generators.
Right. Massive income generator. And like, listen, the show paid for that and we got paid for the show. And also a huge part of that is the talent of the musical artist and of the host. But like, there isn't any inclusion like at that point, if these videos are under 5 minutes, of the people who write those things that go viral. So it's like, even that, and that's not even something that's on the table in it. They just, the companies, if they would have been, and they're never going to do this because they're corporations, but if they would have come to the table and been like, okay, we need to make sure that like our writers can afford. Bill Maher said it's a make or miss league. And that is true. There are a lot of people who come to LA, try to become a TV writer, fail, and have to move back home. Our problem is the people with the makes aren't making any money on it. That's what it is. And that's what I wish Bill Maher would understand. And like, some idea that the 2007 strike was somehow more morally justified.
If Bill Maher was a French grocery store chain,
that's right,
he would be singing a different tune.
He absolutely would.
Well, let me ask you this, Ian. I was listening to another podcast about the industry called The Town, and they talked about like the effects of the strike in an ongoing way, like the damage basically of the strike. And it's funny because they weren't being like anti-writer, anti-actor about it, but they were just like, the damage that the strike will cause are these possible things. And one of them was late night. Do you feel like, as someone who was, you know, heavily in the grips of late night, do you feel like late night has lost some of its primacy?
Yes, but not because of the strike. I do think it's something that is hastening the maybe death of it in certain ways.
Death is a strong word.
I think we will have Fallon. I think we will have Colbert but I think those are probably the last people who will have those jobs unless something like shocking happens. I think speaking of primacy, like of having a news story break in the day and then having jokes about it that night, which was kind of one of the big appeals of late night, in addition to like access to celebrities. Those are both two things. I mean, like the immediacy of jokes and access to celebrities that social media has just takes care of faster and maybe, I don't know if better, but definitely faster and like more in your face. Yeah.
Yeah. I would almost never say better.
Yeah.
Because I think there's so much more thought and care and editing that goes on with your job than anyone puts in on their fucking Twitter feed. You know what I mean?
But it's the volume is hard to compete with.
Yeah.
It's just it's that like the, you know, the food is terrible and there's so little, you know, but the portions are huge.
Yeah.
So like
the portions are so small. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's funny. Because I've always gotten the thrill out of seeing what the show. I'm such a dork, but like I fucking DVR late night shows.
Yeah,
so that I can watch the monologue, and I don't watch it every day. But like, you know, it's like I'd like to know what Colbert or Seth Meyers or something like has to say about these things, what those writers cooked up, what kind of polish the host put on it, and. And I just like to know. I like to see it, even though like I have access to the internet, I can see a bunch of fucking dumb jokes. It's like I still would like to know what the masters think.
There's something and there's something very comfortable about that. There's a very I remember when we started the show, Jay Leno, like we were thinking about not doing a monologue because like I think every show when they start on late night, they're like, how can we shake it up and reinvent the form? And we were like, maybe we won't do a monologue. And he said, Jay Leno came in and was like, you have to do a monologue. Because you're welcoming the viewer, you know, to your house, to your show. It's a very welcoming energy. And I think those of us who like grew up with it still very much
feel that way.
This warm studio and this audience laughing and this charismatic person like welcoming you there. But like, I was on our show for the last 3 years of it, like every single night, like during the monologue, and I never got recognized. But when I told people I worked on our show, they were like, oh, I love that show. And what they meant was, I love watching a YouTube clip or a TikTok of a carpool karaoke. And I think that more and more is how people who are younger, like, just are going to interact with those kind of things.
Are consuming things. Yeah. They're not DVRing the monologue.
No. But, you know, the other reason that, like, late night is sort of, like, trapped in this thing is because, like, well-compensated late night is on network television. If it were possible, for instance, like a streamer or like, you know, some version of YouTube to be like fairly or commensurately compensated, maybe, you know, like a person like James Corden or whatever would be able to pivot to a more like nimble, less in the network thing and still like bring his skills that people want to the globe. It's just like not possible either. Like,
yeah. And, I mean, Andrew, what about the other thing that people are bandying about, which is just that there's going to be fewer shows in general, and that just the schedule for 2024 is going to be fucked. Can you talk a little bit about how you see that, all that stuff coming down the pike?
I mean, the schedule is fucked. I think the thing that is fascinating is watching the conglomeration of studios that we are striking. I guess we're striking against all the studios, not necessarily members of the AMPTP, but the studio negotiating group is called the AMPTP, which I am not speaking for the guild or other writers in any way. I'm only not even Ian. I'm speaking for myself. It is weird how this has become like sort of this like death cult, this anti-union death cult among the studios.
It's weird.
They are way past financial sense. Like we and the actors are not asking for enough to justify the amount of money they have lost. And individual members, like it is nearing, unless something happens in the next couple of days, which it might, by the way, the, as of recording, negotiations seem
have
like
resumed.
They're resumed
today.
But, yeah. So far, every negotiation has also been a publicity stunt by the AMPTP. So we'll see. You know, it's not clear whether real negotiations have resumed. However, like, you know, I like Sony, an entity that doesn't have a streaming platform, and most of our demands, not all, but, you know, a good majority of our demands sort of go to the streaming business model. Like, they're set to just drive off a cliff with Netflix in an effort to save Netflix only, well, Netflix, Apple, and Amazon only, and not have a 2024 blockbuster theatrical season.
I wouldn't do that if I were running
Sony. I mean, my favorite thing, I wish I'd, like, clocked who wrote this tweet. But my favorite tweet that sort of summarizes this is I saw someone wrote, "Dear CBS, Sheldon ain't getting no younger." Like, why are they defending Netflix? This is so crazy to me. But yes, we are poised to have, you know, sports and news only for your TV screens in 2024 if these fools don't get their act together.
And meanwhile, Netflix is more than happy to just keep putting out, like, dubbing, like, Czechoslovakian television shows, you know what I mean, or whatever, with like an English wash, and then present them like there's some new American show, and it's like, look, we have new content, kind of thing.
That also, by the way, seemed, look, I don't know, they don't release the numbers, it seems like it's not working, because Suits is still running better than these, like, repackaged, and guess what, like, you know, like, I just remember Teenage Andrew. I would love, like, if the global dominated form of media was foreign films, but guess the fuck what? Like, it's not going to happen.
Most people don't want that. Yeah.
I want mouth to match up with word. There's like a lot of people sitting at home yelling that. Also, there used to be, I think one thing we get back to, and like, I mean, there's larger economic forces, but at work here, it used to be the people in charge of these studios at the end of the day loved TV and loved movies and wanted to make it. And now it seems like that's been replaced completely. And this is so saccharine, but like completely with just like a love of money. And there's not even any more like this, like part of it being like, well, at least we make something that we love and people love. And like, I don't know. I just yeah. miss that feeling.
Well, yeah. It's so bizarre.
I think, Andrew, your point about Sony is so on the money. It's so weird because I could just picture Sony being like, you guys, actually, like, what's happening? Like, why would they fall off a cliff? It's so weird. I had been saying for a long time, I was just like, oh, after Labor Day, everyone's going to feel it. There's talks will immediately resume and it'll all be done within days. Like, that was my prediction. And I mean, we'll see what happens today. But yeah. I think the other thing in terms of like drawing blood from people who are protesting, for people who are picketing, it's like we've always been able to have multiple jobs. Like, we know how to do that. So it's like I think it's oddly easier for us to picket than it is for the corporations. You know what I mean?
I don't think Reed Hastings has ever treated Top Ramen as two different meals because you can have the noodles at one and then the sauce packet at the other. Like, I did years doing that, and I was taking improv classes at night. Like, I'm built for this, dude.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Fucking try me. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right, folks, let me know. What do you think of these ongoing? Are you watching Suits? Or do you feel like you've run out of television? Hit me up. Let me know what you're thinking about these ongoing strikes. And let us move on to topic number three. So there's a new biography of Mitt Romney coming out. We read a very juicy excerpt in the Atlantic. And among the many things this piece revealed was that Mitt Romney will totally dish on his colleagues. He's basically, in the parlance of 2019, in the zero fucks phase of his tenure, he's tattletaling on everyone, and notably that they all hate Trump and think he's just a real dum-dum, who probably never thinks about the Roman Empire.
I disagree about that one. I think he's only thinking about the Roman Empire.
Yeah. So we'll talk about some of the details. I'll bring up some of the details. But before we get into all of it, my first question is, were you surprised that Mitt dished so hard and then everybody does actually hate Trump? I mean, I think we all kind of knew that, but it's like fun and nice to hear someone with firsthand knowledge actually say it. The biography writes, in fact, they, quote, ridiculed his ignorance, rolled their eyes at his antics, and made incisive observations about his warped toddler-like psyche. What do you guys think? Were you surprised?
I think he could. I would say, I don't know if he's at zero fucks given, because I think he could dish harder.
Yeah. That's interesting. Okay.
I think he has a lot of fucking dirt. And look, I know he doesn't have a time machine, but it's also a little like, yeah, you're doing it now of it is a little like, Come on. It's nice to hear, but
I feel like this is his version of zero fucks, yes, as a gentlemanly Mormon. Yeah.
Right.
As you know what I mean?
I would have been surprised before I saw The Real Housewives of Salt Lake. And now I'm like, oh, okay. They got this gear. This is a gear. I don't know. I think it's, I guess I'm not surprised. I think, like you said, I think this is his version of like hit him up. This is what Mitt Romney is capable of from behind an $8,000 buttoned blazer, you know, with brass buttons kind of thing. Like, it's a strange thing, like the Overton window, right? It moves so much that all of a sudden you find yourself like, yeah, fucking go off, Mitt Romney. You know what I mean? Where you're like.
But I mean, here's the thing that I was really struck by too. And I don't often think, I gotta be honest, like I don't often think about the peril of speaking out against Trump. And I mentioned this on the podcast before, but like I've been in right-wing crosshairs, named an Islamo-fascist in the Daily Caller and Breitbart and those kinds of websites.
And I'm sorry about those articles. It was before I became familiar with your podcast.
This is before clicks. You turn into a late night writer. Yeah. But I, you know, and it is unpleasant, right? And, you know, and I've gotten threats and all that stuff. It's totally, totally unpleasant. So I get that there's like fear involved. What Mitt Romney describes sounds way fucking scarier in terms of like the danger you put yourself in, you know?
Yeah.
I was in right-wing crosshairs before Trump came to office, and I thought it was like unsavory. Like, this sounds really outright dangerous. He spends, as the article points out, $5,000 a day on security for his family.
Man, I got you for $2,000, by the way. Just not to undercut. Just throw it out there.
Thank you. But, you know, that's not the kind of money that everyone can throw around. Mitt Romney is extremely rich. So I think, do you feel a touch more sympathy with everybody knowing how dangerous it is to speak out because Trump fans are so fanatical?
I think I'm coming at this from the farther left perspective, which is like, if I'm in his shoes, I'm like, members of my own political party, of which I am a prominent national leader and recent presidential candidate, might murder me. Mm. I have credible fears of them murdering me, but I am sticking with these guys because I gotta keep my taxes low. And I just find that to be a type of like cravenness that I find less like. I just don't, because you can leave. You can leave, my man. Like, no one is forcing you to be a Republican
but
except
also,
for yourself.
Also, what I'm understanding is that if, in fact, like 95% of these people actually do, who publicly support Trump, actually think he's dumb and dangerous, if they just chatted to each other and were like, hey, today, let's all reveal that we don't support him anymore, then Trump is over, because Trump has followers that keep him relevant, yeah. But that's not where he gets the real relevance. Comes from his support from Congress.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Otherwise, he's just like a TikToker with a fan base. You know what I'm saying? So like it's I feel like the real relevance comes from the besuited members of Congress who are not speaking out. If they all just banded together, did it all at once, I think we could really do some business
maybe. Listen, I'm just saying, not to go back to Roman Empire, but, you know, senators used to handle shit. you know, just saying.
Well, now I'm going to think about it every day. But also all of these members of Congress are hanging on by a thread. You know what I mean? And like are constantly worried about, although, I mean, we've seen a little bit of that swing the other way in certain elections with like the anti-Trump candidate Republicans. But like they're all terrified at the same time. So even like the idea of banding together is like we can band together and then next election, half of us are gone. You know, like kind of thing. And I also think like, I try to not indulge the more alarmist parts of my psyche because I just don't think that's good for anyone. But like there is, you know, like if you read like Jeff Charlotte or like any of those other people who like cover this kind of thing, the idea of like relevant parts of this country thinking that a civil war is going to happen. Like they're like preparing for it, buying guns for it. They think it's going to happen like how Christmas is swinging around this December, like that kind of thing. And I guess if you're amongst those communities more often and you hear from those people more often, like it would feel a lot scarier. And there's probably some semblance of feeling like you have either created or at least indulged this monster or ridden the wave of this monster to where you're at. And then having also a sense of having lost control of it or never having had control over it, like in the first place. And I think that is really like, you know, that's unnerving. That's really scary.
Let me point out a couple of other little tidbits from the piece. 20 senators here do all the work and 80 are along for the ride was part of it, which I thought was really kind of funny and also sort of like, I just picture them all in like their own little cubicles, like complaining about how, you know what I mean? Like 20 of them being like, oh, I have to do it because fucking Richard Burr's not doing it, you know, or whatever. So I think that was funny. Also, they all, the senator's gym is a scene. And he describes like Richard Burr on a treadmill, like wearing his like pantsuit and like loafers, which I just, love that scene. It also, I'm like, I get maybe you're at a hotel, you're traveling in a pinch. You really need to like just clear your head, just get on that treadmill with your like suit on. I get that. But at your home gym, where you have like where you could bring a gym bag, like let's, what are we doing?
Mitt Romney's work ethic at 70 is truly, that is very impressive. The fact that he's like, let's do this when he could just chill. And also you just kind of know in a slightly different world, he'd be one of those I'm retired gym influencer TikTok guys.
Oh, yeah. Where he like, you know, when he reads the London Financial Times, he's in a plank the entire time.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
My God.
Yes. Ride set, baby.
But the other funny thing about the piece was like, you know, he's got this whatever wonderful family, wonderful wife, the whole thing at home. But in D.C., he's kind of lonely, you know, like the GOP doesn't want to really be seen with him. So he's like, I can't you know, he can't do that. His wife doesn't like coming to D.C. So like the house is empty. There's nothing in the refrigerator. He's probably is making two meals out of a, you know, a ramen.
Yeah.
And
but he's getting the good shit.
Oh, yeah. He's getting that. It's flown in from Erewhon. He knows. Mitt Romney knows about Erewhon. He's got that. He wears Selfish jeans every now and then. He knows.
Okay, well, I'll just end by saying, and I maybe mentioned this last week, I'm not sure, that he announced his retirement.
Yeah.
And encouraged Trump and Biden to join him to make way for younger people. Obviously, this will have no impact, but will this have an impact?
I just like how he's like the ripped Flanders of DC. He's just like, like so good and so pure in a way, but like it's just never good. He's not for this world or this time.
Mitt Romney, not for this world or this time.
The generational schism of, I guess, politicians in general, but especially like conservative politicians. I don't know if this is something that every generation goes through and now it's just our turn, but like he is one of the few true like old guard conservatives who like kind of built their brand up the old fashioned way. And like, and then you have this other, the Lauren Boberts and the, you know, like those people who like got it, like this like new kind of conservative where you kind of wonder, like, do you even believe what you're saying? Or are you just doing this like for clout kind of thing? And I did, for as much as I disagreed with him on fundamental things, I did think that Mitt Romney maybe believed in what he was saying, even if he was just saying it because he's a rich guy and he wants his taxes to be lower.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I don't know. I guess there's something. It's the enemy I understood. And now it's, I do miss like that. Now the new enemy is one where I'm like, I feel about it the way I feel about TikTok follower, people with 500,000 followers, where I'm like, I don't understand any of this.
Right. And he's one of those guys that if like he had become president in 2012, we would have been like, oh, but like, okay. Like it wouldn't have been, it's like the kind of president we've understood.
Yeah.
Right. Like conservative presidents that we've understood. It's like, nah, you know, it's not awesome, but like, it'll be fine.
It's like, well, I'm getting on this airplane. At least the pilot knows how to fly this plane, even though, you know what I mean? Even though it's like,
exactly.
It's flying to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. I don't want to go there. And like, you know, if Lauren Boebert or somebody else, if Tim Scott or whoever, if they get their hands on the plane, I'm like, we're going to crash in the side of a mountain. Everyone's going to die.
Yeah.
Folks, on that note, all right, that is the end of the show. What a fantastic show. I mean, how great are the two of you at fucking chatting? So good. And I want the people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and the wonderful things that you do. Andrew, where do they do that?
You know, yo, is this racist? I'm on Twitter at Andrew T. I get, you know, find me on Spill. Whatever, who cares? If you want, same name at social media, it's fine.
Definitely follow Andrew. Definitely listen to Yo, Is This Racist? I know we have some crossover audience listeners, so yes. It's such a fantastic podcast. Ian, where do they find you?
I'm Ian Carmel with a K on Twitter, TikTok, Instagram, all those places. You can listen to my podcast, All Fantasy Everything, where we fantasy draft pop culture things. So it'll just anything from the world of pop culture. And yeah, come see me on tour doing stand-up comedy. I'll be in Vancouver, BC. I'll be in, Austin, Texas. I'm doing Portland, Oregon, Revolution Hall soon. So, just find me on my socials and pre-order T-shirt Swim Club.
Pre-order T-shirt Swim Club, you guys. It sounds like such a phenomenal book. You should pull quote me, phenomenal book, and I haven't even read it.
Phenomenal book. Like,
yes. Folks, you know where to find me and all the things that I do, but just a reminder that I'll be at MIT on Friday, but then I'll also be in San Diego doing the Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me stand-up tour on September 27th. I'll be in San Francisco on September 29th. I have dates coming up in Philly and DC. And so I would love to see you in these many American towns. We want to thank everyone who makes this show a possibility. That's our wonderful producer, Andrew McGuire. Thanks to Gabby Alter for our wonderful theme music. Thanks to everyone at HeadGum for making the show a possibility. If you have any ideas, suggestions, thoughts, please email them at fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's fakethenationpodcast@gmail.com. And otherwise, we will be back in your earballs next week.
That was a HeadGum podcast.